And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Everyone, I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Bobby Caldwell started playing at the age of 10, and by 14 was playing professionally with many rock groups in the state of Florida, but primarily Noah's Ark out of Tampa. After signing with Decca Records and releasing two singles, the band played constantly throughout the eastern U.S. After paying his dues, fate stepped in. At the age of 19, he was asked to join Johnny Winter's new supergroup, Johnny Winter Ann. This group featured Rick Derringer and Randy Hobbs, formerly with the McCoys of Hang On Sloopy fame. The album Johnny Winter and Live was recorded in New York and Miami and became a top 10 bestseller and Johnny's highest charting album. Bobby also played on Johnny Winter's Saints and Sinners album, recording with Edgar Winter, Rick Derringer, and the late Dan Hartman. Rick Derringer asked Bobby to play on his first solo LP, All American Boy, which was recorded entirely at Caribou Ranch in Colorado. This partnership produced the classic top 10 hit, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. While touring with the Allman Brothers Band as a third drummer and percussionist, Caldwell had the pleasure of playing with them at the Fillmore East when they recorded their historic album, The Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East. In the early days to mid-70s, Captain Beyond arose from the ashes of Iron Butterfly, Johnny Winter, and Deep Purple. Introduced to Phil Walden by the late Dwayne Allman, the band signed with Capricorn Records. Captain Beyond's first album remains a progressive rock cult classic to this day. The band enjoys heavy airplay on satellite radio and a large following in Europe and the Far East. Bobby's contributions to the music, lyrics, and song arrangements are evident throughout. Following Captain Beyond, he was enlisted to join the supergroup Armageddon, founded by the late Keith Rell from the Yardbirds. Armageddon comprised of England's renowned super guitarist Martin Pugh, Bobby Caldwell, and Louis Chinamo. The group produced one album from A&M Records. Once again, Bobby was a major contributor to the songwriting and direction of the band. In the early 1980s, MCA Records offered Bobby a solo deal. The album was unfortunately never completed. Through the 80s and 90s, Bobby continued to sing, write new material, and play drums while fronting his own band before moving back to Florida from Los Angeles for family obligations. Recently, Bobby has been playing with the reformed Captain Beyond as well as many other projects. He is a dedicated professional, always looking for new and exciting musical ventures. Highly spiritual, Bobby also holds a master's degree in metaphysics and is an ordained metaphysical minister. He neither smokes nor drinks nor uses drugs and lives an extremely clean lifestyle. He is truly a sincere, humble, and caring artist. His love and motivation to create new music is, as it has always been, steadfast and unwavering. Please welcome legendary drummer, songwriter, singer, and producer Bobby Caldwell to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Bobby.
Hello there, Ray.
How are things?
Very well indeed, sir. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing fine. We're both in the state of Florida, which we're enjoying pretty nice weather, as a matter of fact.
So far,
yeah. We're going to get into the rainy season here pretty soon. Captain Beyond is alive and well. And, you know, the band originally formed in 1971. Now, you guys got some concert dates coming up. And the first one here is here in Bradenton, Florida at Aces Live Music, coming up on June 3rd. So that's going to be pretty exciting. And I'll be at that show for sure.
Yes, that's going to be the sort of the tip-off, the first one with the new band, and we're all pretty excited about playing there and really getting back out and playing the music for the people, you know, that would like to hear it. So, yeah, that's going to be the first show there at Aces.
And you're coming up Harrisonburg, Virginia, on June 22nd at the Golden Pony. You'll be in Maryland Doomfest, Frederick, Maryland, on June 23rd at the Cafe 611. At the Earl in Atlanta, August 16th. The Poorhouse Music Hall in Raleigh, August 18th. Kung Fu Necktie in Philly, August 20th. St. Vitus, I guess, or Vitus, in Brooklyn, August 22nd. August 25th, the Bear's Den, Seneca Niagara Casino in Niagara Falls, New York. And one of my stomping grounds, Ram's Head Live, Days of Darkness Fest in Baltimore, Maryland. And you got much more to come as far as concert dates. So we're all looking forward to those shows. The original lineup of Captain Beyond was singer Ron Evans, you on drums, guitarist Larry Rhino Reinhardt, who is a local here, from Iron Butterfly, and bassist Lee Dorman, of course, from Iron Butterfly. That was the original. You know what is very strange is it's hard to believe Rod Evans, who was with Deep Purple, you know, and you see him on YouTube with the Playboy After Dark singing Hush, was the same Rod Evans that was in Captain Beyond. It's like totally different people. He was unbelievable with Captain Beyond.
Yeah, Rod is an extraordinarily talented man. I can't, you know, when you hear people say these kinds of things just to you know, sound noble, but I really mean that. He along with Keith Ralph have got to be two of the great lyricists in the history of rock music. The problem is the music sort of overshadows the things that he writes as a lyricist and a singer. But you know, that the coming together of Captain Beyond, I was playing with Johnny, of course, and the Almonds, and I got a letter or a text, some kind of a something from a telegram saying, you know, Iron Butterfly is breaking up. And of course, they were, to say that they were hugely successful, I'm not even talking about the music that some people, you know, may or may not care for, but I'm talking about as far as success, they were as big as anybody could get, just about. And they were breaking up. So they wanted to ask me if I was interested in starting this group with them. So it was a very strange coincidence of events very quickly that Johnny decided to take some time off, but the time off was unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like they said, hey, listen, you know, well, everybody just, you know, sort of hang about and wait. And so it was sort of like, well, we don't know what's happening either, I think. So I went out to L.A. and we started Captain Beyond. And Rod initially wasn't really around at the beginning. He sort of came in a very short time afterward, and I had relocated there from London, and you know, that's how we started, sort of pulling the band together. So you know, the main thing is my influence, or my headstrong, you know, opinion was we have to do something different. You
right.
know, we have to do something different. We cannot go up here and play, you know, standard 1-4-5 rock and roll and hope that anybody cares. You know, I mean, this is
yep.
So this is really what was behind it. So almost everything that we approached was sort of run by the quirky committee to see, you know,
yeah.
to see, is this really doing what it's supposed to do? Or wait a minute here, what are you playing? You know, that kind of stuff. And that's pretty much how it started happening. And there was five of us originally. We had a keyboard player, Louis Gold from up here in the Central Florida area. And the more and more that we, you know, kind of congregated every day, we went every day to Rhino's house. It was like a regular job, Ray. Every day we drove to his house, all of us. It was a regular job. And rehearsed or began songs or had song ideas and started, you know, it was a very serious affair. And so that's pretty much what happened. That was the beginnings right there.
You guys were very serious musicians. I mean, you know, when you listen to, you know, commercial rock back in the 70s, and then you listen to, like, kind of the underground, the cool guys, the guys that are real serious rock and that you know, you feel cool when you listen to, that's Captain Beyond, you know? They were one of those bands, you know, those bands that you felt cool. You really, you know, that was rock. That was the real McCoy right there. Even today there are so many different Captain Beyond fans out there. It's like a cult following. Your original album, I guess, Captain Beyond, which was remastered on, and it's on Amazon. Listen to this. It's got 296 customer reviews and 4.5 stars. You know how hard that is on Amazon to get 4.5 stars after 300 customer reviews? That's almost impossible. Yeah.
Yeah, I honestly wouldn't know that, but that's a good thing. That's great, you know.
And people are saying it's possibly the greatest rock album of all time.
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that for some reason, the music has remained year to year, almost like it's never gone. You know, it's just like it was years ago,
right?
And the enthusiasm, Ray, is what shocks me. These people are diehard music. I mean, these are music fans. These people from everywhere.
Yep.
And so, the journey. You know, when we, the one thing that should be known is that when we put the band together, we did a series of demos, which have just been released on Cleopatra Records, called
yep.
Epic Lost and Found.
Yep, I just called them up recently.
Yeah, and the Lost and Found album has the original 20-minute demo on there.
Yep.
That we shopped around. It's the same demo that Rhino and I played for Greg and Dwayne.
Mm.
At the Hyatt House in L.A. when the Allman Brothers came to play the Whiskey.
Wow.
And, we played it for Dwayne, and Dwayne just about jumped out of his shoes and got on the phone to Phil Walden, right? I mean, literally while we were sitting there on the bed, you know? And so, that was the beginning of sort of the journey of seeing, you know, and one thing led to another. So, you know, we were fortunate to get a lot of support from him at the beginning. It was not a Southern rock band. It had nothing to do with quote unquote Southern rock music, whatever that is. I'll tell you that story in a minute. But it somehow, you know, because of, you know, Dwayne's enormous influence on Phil,
mm-hmm.
He wanted it. I mean, he wanted it seriously. And we could and should have gone to several other companies and shopped it around. But it was one of those kind of things where it was, how much do you need and what do you want to do?
Yeah.
No problem. Yes to all the question you have. My answer is yes.
Right.
Well, that's pretty hard to turn down. I mean, you know.
Well, that was kind of the beginning of the demise. Was you guys were on Capricorn, and they had a sudden change of heart. They wanted you guys to look for your Southern side, I guess, and be a lot like the Allman Brothers because they were so successful. But you guys didn't have a Southern side.
No, well, they didn't really want, I'm not so sure they wanted that, but they were just trying to be, you know, they didn't understand the impact of the music. They did not understand. And so this was, this began a sort of downward spiral in the relationship. It really wasn't that anyone had any, you need to be doing more of this, sort of like Atlantic did with Zeppelin when the folk craze with Crosby, Stills, and Nash and all of that sort of acoustic stuff, James Taylor started coming in 70, 71. I'm told that they had a word with Peter Grant and the rest of them that, hey, you might be good doing a bit more of those. They didn't really do that to us. They just said, Phil Walden, that I recall, they just, you know, said, well, sort of have at it. But there was, you know, there was a lot of things going on, so... and I'm not just talking about the drug use or anything that everybody was involved in. I'm just talking about in general.
Right,
there was
a lot
going on. And that was the beginning.
Was it your manager also, the manager, the head of Capricorn?
You've just hit the ball out of the park. In and of itself is a it's an illegal thing to be doing. It's a conflict of interest. You can't do that. And if you said to me, and you'd have every right to, why would you all sign a contract giving the record company head and the manager the same the same right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that. I really don't know that. And that should have been, not to lay blame on anyone, but that should have been caught certainly by our legal team, but it wasn't. And that's what we got. And that we had a long conversation with Joe Smith one day out at Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out there to talk to him about the problems at hand. And he loved us. He said, Bobby, if you guys had signed directly to us, we could fix these problems right now. But you didn't. And we only distributed it, so we don't really have any legs in it. So it was, just trying to work out problems and make it happen.
Right. Such a great band, you know, and such a short existence. But now you're back.
we're back. You know, that I want to say something for the listeners, because a lot of times people are interested in how things sort of culminated.
Right.
There's a song on there called Dancing Madly Backwards.
Right.
And this, it's in 5/4 time, which is mm-hmm. an odd time signature. But the drum pattern that seems to be, in some circles, rather interesting, was something I used to just play at rehearsal, or I would just set up and I would just start banging out some kind of a thing. It really was... it was really the centerpiece for it, but it really wasn't intended to be initially. It was just something that I played. And then the lyrics of Dancing Madly Backwards was something that I started writing down about drug use and how that, once the drugs wear off, you know, it's just a sea of air. There's nothing there. It's not like it's permanent. And so the whole thing, that's what it's about. And so I would, and so we just, Rhino put the progression to it, the chords to it, da 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 da. And then Rod wrote the melody, and off we go to the races.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, sort of how that happened. Ditto to, a lot of those other pieces that are on that album. So.
Well, everybody needs to buy Lost and Found, 1972-73 release date. We're looking at June 2nd, according to Cleopatra. And Cleopatra is supposed to send me a copy of it, but I haven't gotten it yet. I was hoping to have it before the interview.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'll see. They'll probably get it late. They'll, we'll see.
Yeah, there's I want to tell you, Ray, there's a version of, there's two songs on there that Rod are singing that nobody's heard him sing. And one of them is a version, it's a version of Raging River of Fear that I think is better than the album.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I mean, Rhino's playing slide on it, and, you know, and it was just a different take. But I think it's very good. And then, you know, there's another one called Icarus that we recorded it on the third album, but it was not by Rod singing. It was with Willie. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but I think they're all on there. And so I think the listeners will like it, you know.
Well, later on, in around 2000, you guys, I think you wrote Night Train Calling, right? Is that you?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, man. There's three songs I saw on YouTube. I guess Night Train Calling was an EP. And
yes.
These tracks weren't on an album, right? Gotta Move and Be As You Were?
No.
No. Okay. Well, people got to go on YouTube and Night Train Calling, Gotta Move, and Be As You Were. These were released what, in 2000. Is that true? Around that time?
I think it was like 2001. Uh huh.
Okay, so you know, even more recent, Captain Beyond. These songs are great, man. They're really, really good. Night Train Calling is awesome. You did a great job on that.
Thank you. You know what's really weird about that is those songs. Those songs, Ray, were supposed to be just demos, and they weren't even supposed to be put out.
Right.
And somebody, enthusiastic member of the band, I believe, decided to post it up on YouTube.
Hmm.
But the point is that they really weren't finished. They really weren't finished. Yeah, I mean, you know, even now when I hear it, I'm thinking, my goodness. You know, but they weren't finished. Rhino was supposed to put some other guitar parts on certain things, and yeah, they were just sort of put up there, and that was it. You know,
you'll have to put those tracks on a new album.
we actually may re-record a couple of those.
Good.
You know, to get the sound better.
Yeah.
And to try to improve it and maybe tweak the song a little bit as far as the arrangement. But, yeah, we'll probably – but thank you for the compliment on that.
Oh, they're great. You think Night Train Calling, you'll be – any chance you'll be playing that on this mini tour you're on?
Yeah, we'll be playing it. Yeah.
Good. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, we'll be doing that.
Rhino says the name Captain Beyond came from Chris Squire. Is that true?
Well, that's a good question. What happened was, and Lee Dorman and I talk about this,
right?
Is when the Butterfly were on their last tour, you know, every time that Rhino would come down in the morning, Lee would say, Lee really loved Rhino, and he would tease him just unrelenting. It was just fabulous. I mean, if you wanted some entertainment, and it was all done in good, you know, good nature. So Rhino would come down, you know, and Lee would go, look at him like, looking good, you know, looks like he's been in the beyond a little bit. Where are you, you know, what's happening, Rhino? You know, and just sort of, you know, and then another time he would come down and say something about, Dorman, Lee said to me, he'd call Rhino and say, well, the captain's here, man, you know. And so it was all a bit of teasing about the way Rhino would sort of show up a bit shattered the next day,
right.
You know, being up late and, you know. And so it just began to stick to where Captain Beyond became a sort of moniker. As far as Chris, I don't know about that. I don't know that story, but it seems to me you could be right that was bandied about at some point. But that's what Lee told me.
Yeah, Rhino says after a real long night with a pipe, we all partook in some attitude adjustment for the long ride. It was Iron Butterfly and Yes sharing a bus,
There you go.
He was coming out of the bus, and Chris Squire said, "Look at my bloodshot eyes." He looked at his bloodshot eyes and said, "God damn, you look like a Captain Beyond. You look like Captain Beyond." And then the name stuck. That's what Rhino said in an interview.
I would not disagree with that. I mean, that's very well possible. As far as the description, I definitely wouldn't disagree. But as far as, you know, I think it was a combination of Chris saying that and also that they were teasing him on the road as well,
right.
Independent of, yes, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, Rhino was pretty cool.
Great musician. Great musician.
Oh, yeah. You guys were all great musicians.
We, you know, I can't say enough about it. You know, Rhino and I would pretty much be responsible for the music.
Yep.
And I would, if I mentioned to Larry that I've got an idea for a song, he knew exactly what I was talking about. I mean, he would know innately, almost, you mean something like this? And I'd go, yeah, sort of, but, you know, and this was a very magical sort of thing between he and I about the music.
Right.
Now the lyrics was really mostly Rod and I, and the arrangements pretty much they left to me to arrange the song. But that's pretty much what happened. And he was a great musician, and I miss the guy all the time. I mean, you know, Larry was a different kind of man. He was a sort of a solo person. Sort of everyone needs to be alone at some point, you know. But
right.
Larry, you know, sort of you weren't going to call Larry to see if he wanted to go bowling. You know what I mean? you know what I'm saying? It was just that kind of thing. But when we played together, it was always just tremendous, and he was a great player.
Well, you're mentioned a lot in Johnny's book, you know, from Raising Cain. There's a lot of great stories. One story was the Chelsea Hotel after a 12-hour festival at Shea Stadium. You guys were performing in New York, and Janis Joplin comes in and tackles Johnny Winter. You were in the room.
I answered the door. I answered the door.
I guess she was pretty wasted at the time, huh? And knocked Johnny down.
Well, what she did, the knock on the door, Johnny was, you know, in a hotel room. Everybody reclines on the bed, and, you know, I think he was just sitting there on the bed, and I was sitting on the end of the bed talking to him. And there's just the two of us in the room, and there was a knock on the door. So I said, well, you know, I'll get it, you know. And I opened the door, and there was Janis. And by this time, Johnny had sort of sat up, and she just leapt across the bed and tackled him.
That's funny. I got a funny story, a quick one from Mark Farner when I talked to Mark. He says him and Janis, I guess, were good friends, and they just got off the helicopter from some festival or something. And Mick Jagger was going to get on the helicopter right after him. And when Janis got off the helicopter, she got a chocolate bar and put it all over the seat. And then when, you know, Mick got on the helicopter, he was wearing white pants.
Uh-oh.
So I guess she was kind of a joker as well, huh?
Yeah, I bet she was pretty popular too.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
That'll get you sent to a timeout, so to speak.
Definitely. tell your story how you. It's a great story how you joined Johnny Winter.
Well, I'll try to make it brief.
Okay.
as they say in the underwear business. I always have practiced almost every day, right?
Right.
And I get a call one afternoon from a roadie guy that was working with Noah's Ark. And he says to me, how would you like to come over and jam with Johnny Winter this afternoon over here locally? And I said, no, I really wouldn't, you know. And he said, oh, you know, I'll just come on over for a little while, you know. And I said, you know, David, I'm not really interested. That's not my thing. And we talked and we talked and we talked and he kept coming back to this. So will you just come over for a little while? And this is important to understand the how important of what happened because of him talking to me. And I said, and I would decline politely, and then he'd come back to it. Oh, Bobby, will you come over and just play a little bit? And you know, it'd be a lot of fun. And I'd say, really? You know, it's 200 degrees outside at the moment. And I said, finally, something said to me, that inner voice said, you need to go over and do this. So I go over to this house, and I pull up, and all these people are inside. You can hear, all this mayhem, you know, coming through the window. And all these people are standing around out front, mingling, talking, local people, musicians, people that wanted to be a musician, people that have bought an instrument, people who are dreaming of being a musician or some nonsense. And so I start standing around there, and we stand around, and time, 30 minutes goes by, and I'd see Dave sort of flitting about. I said, Dave, you know, is it time, you know, is it time that, you know, they want me to come in and, you know, we got to play? Or... And I, no, hang on a second, I'll let you know. And so another half hour go by, 45 minutes, you know, and now it's really heating up, you know, and we're still standing around, and this goes on and on. Well, at some point, I said to him, Dave, listen, I'm going to leave. I said, I'm going to go home and eat with my parents, because I lived with my parents at the time.
Right.
I said, and I'm going to, you know, take my girlfriend out. Who was definitely worth taking out, believe me. And he said, no, hang on a second. Let me check. So he goes in and disappears again for another 20 minutes. So I'm just about ready to leave, and out he comes, and he goes, okay, Bobby, they're ready for you, you know, and that. And I'd see these people coming in and out the front door, you know, this whole time. Okay, whatever, you know. So I go in, and I come in the front door, and in the living room standing is Johnny Winter, Edgar Winter, Randy Hobbs, Rick Derringer, Steve Paul, the manager of Johnny,
right.
Road manager Teddy Slatus, assorted road crew people, and there's a drum set in the corner of the room. I'm thinking, oh yeah, yeah, I mean, this thing was really is this what they're playing on, you know? So I shook hands, said, "Oh, it's great to meet." Now, by this time, Ray, I'm very frustrated with the delay. It's very hot. So by the time I sat down, I mean, I was fired up, and I started playing this really intense Tony Williams type of pattern on the drums, and they just joined in and started playing right along with me. So we're all playing along, and we're jamming, and we're playing along, and this and that. But all of a sudden, we start going through these different rock and roll type things, and you know, standard Chuck Berry type feel,
right,
and,
right,
and different you know songs and slow blues, you know, imagine that. And
yeah.
we go through all of this stuff. 35 minutes later, anyway, it comes to a crashing halt, and Johnny looks at me and goes, "I want you to be in my band." And Edgar, standing no more than 3 feet behind him, says, "I want you to be in my band." And that is exactly how it happened. But the significant part of the story was, not only was I sort of stunned at the proposal,
mm-hmm.
but I come to find out that it wasn't a jam at all. The whole damn thing had been an audition.
An audition.
That's what they were doing.
Sneaky. Very
so
sneaky.
That's what happened. And that's, you know, we were off to the races after that.
Yeah. Huh. I guess if they didn't want you, they could have. You wouldn't have ever known. You know, they wouldn't have said anything, and it would have just been like a jam. You know, but
that's all.
Yeah.
They just never would have called me or said anything.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they just would have, like everybody else, they just would have moved on. And
yep.
Fortunately, a lot of the people that where they stopped in different places on the way down to Florida, they were asking people, you know, do you know any drummer? Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. So there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of stars lining up, and I felt very blessed to have that opportunity.
Sure.
And, you know, and I had been working very diligently toward that. So it was just sort of like a perfect meeting that day, you know.
It's quite an honor because there's a lot of great drummers at that time, too, you know. So
absolutely.
Yeah. It just proves you're one of the best, man.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but we just keep trying to play a little bit better all the time.
Yeah. Talk about, you know, Jimi Hendrix dies. Talk about 21st Century Man.
Okay. Johnny Winterand was playing in Boston that night, and we were playing at the Boston Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the opening band was the Jay Giles Blues Band.
Right.
And so when that happened, I was, you know, we were in Boston and just as shocked as anybody. I mean, shocked.
Yeah.
And we went back to the hotel. I'm surprised you know about this record, 21st Century Man. A lot of people don't even know it. I think it's a quite good record. Johnny sings it good.
Right.
And so we started sort of, you know, putting it together and so on and so forth. And when we got back to New York, we recorded it. But the interesting thing that I'll tell you, Ray,
mm-hmm.
is that there was a man that was driving for Johnny and for Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy was living in the Village at this time.
Right.
And this man that used to drive for us, you know, had this tremendous head of hair, you know, everybody's hair was huge, you know. And he would pick us up at the airport and pick different people up and do errands and stuff, and he got paid to do that. So one day he picks me up from the airport. This goes directly to your question. He says to me, Bobby, he goes, you know, Jimmy's looking for a new drummer. I said, what? he goes, he's looking for a new drummer. I said, what happened to Mitch? He goes, I don't know. He and Jimmy had some falling out about some girl or something. I don't really know. And he's going to be wanting to try out some people. And I went, you're kidding, right? He says, no. He says, when we get to the hotel, I'm going to call him. When we got to the hotel, he called him. And he said, I've got this young kid that's playing with Johnny Winterand at the moment, and I think you should hear him, blah, blah, blah. And Jimmy said, well, I've got to go to Europe for a couple of weeks. When I get back, I'll have him come down to Electric Ladyland. And, of course, that goes to about 21st Century Man was written about the death of Jimmy. And that was what was. I was the only one in the room that knew that I might be having a play with Jimmy. So,
you know, it makes sense because he was really going in a different direction near the end of his life. So that does make sense that he would look for another drummer.
Well, I mean, he and Mitch played so great together. Mitch was such a great player with him. That, you know, but people being people, you know, you just don't know why people have, you know, differences. And who knows, Ray, he might have, you know, he might have tried out four mm-hmm. or five, six people and then, you know, made up with Mitch and then moved on forward just the same way. I mean, you know, you just don't know any of those things.
Yep.
So, but that's the story about 21st Century Man, that if anybody has a chance to, I don't even know if it's on YouTube, but if you have a chance to listen to it, you know, it's just a nice song that Johnny, you know, sings very well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were part of that recording, yet I don't think you got credit for that, right? Wasn't that where you should have gotten some credit for that song as well, or that's what I heard?
No, I mean, I played on it, but okay. I didn't I didn't really contribute anything lyrically or I just played on it.
Right.
But it's a quite good song. I don't listen to it very often, Ray, but when I do, you know, I listen to, I have trouble listening to anything that I play on or sing on. I mean it. It's never good enough.
That's normal.
Should have been done better. What was I thinking? You know, all of that crap.
Yeah, that's normal.
And
I hear that a lot over and over again.
Well, when, like, if Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo comes on, as fine of a performance as I think Rick did on it, and it was just the two of us in the room recording it. Nobody else was in that room in Colorado when we recorded that at Caribou. It was just he and I and the producer. And when I hear that only come on the radio, I think, oh, man, yes. Can I change this? Or, and not, you know, it's not because you're not proud of it or whatever. It's just, it's never quite good. At, you know, I could have done this or, I don't know. And I think this is a sort of illness that befalls most people. You hear something again you've done, you go, oh, you know, if you're an actor, I could have acted that scene better this, you know, this time. Turn this way instead of that. I don't know.
Yeah. Johnny Depp doesn't watch any of his films. Once he does,
is that right?
Yep. Same thing.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to watch him.
I can't do it. I mean, a couple of times I've tripped over some things on the satellite radio, and if I haven't heard them for a long time, I might listen to them and just to critique it. You know. Let's see. Yeah, this and that, and so. One time I heard the buzzard come on and with Armageddon, and it sounded like there was, a nuclear war had started. Because I wasn't used to hearing it come on the radio. You know,
I know.
The radio's been so long.
Yeah. Well, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo, which is a classic rock mainstay for years and years to come, you played on that with Rick. And also Johnny Winter did it. Now, did you play on the Johnny Winter version as well?
I did not. That was Randy, Rick's brother, played that.
Okay. And I think Edgar also did it with White Trash, didn't he?
Did Edgar do it?
I heard he did it.
Yeah. He might have done it. I thought the butler did it, but I think Edgar might have done it. But the version on Johnny Winter Ann, for those who don't know, is the feel of the song is quite different than the way Rick and I did it.
Right.
It's very good. I mean, and Johnny was just a tremendous singer. I just can't say enough about Johnny Winter as a singer. I mean, everybody talks about him as a guitar player. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But as a singer, and the last time I saw him, we got together for a couple of hours, and we had some time, and I said to him, I started telling him what a great singer. I mean, I wasn't trying to flatter him or embarrass, I mean, I just tell it straight, the truth. And I said, you know, people don't know what a great singer you are, Johnny. That's exactly what I said to him.
Yeah,
and if you listen to No Time to Live, you've heard that song, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
On the Johnny Winter Ann album, No Time to Live.
Yep.
It's just a spectacular vocal performance by Johnny.
Yeah.
Just a spectacular. And that's where they got their version of Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo too, which I thought was quite good. I think the whole album is quite good, actually.
What was I going to say here? I just lost my train of thought. It happens.
Uh-oh. That's okay.
I want to get into the supergroup, Armageddon, which was formed in 1974. When that album came out, I knew it was going to be great. Love the album. Again, it's got cult status. But you guys were actually in pretty good shape as far as backing with that, because you had... originally, you were managed by D'Anthony, right? Who managed Frampton, Humble Pie, ELP, and later Jerry Weintraub from Frank Sinatra and Dylan.
That's correct.
Yeah, and you also had Peter Frampton was kind of helping you guys in a way, right? It gave you a little bit of backing.
Well, let's see. There's another very interesting story, which I won't bore everyone with, but Ainsley Dunbar gave Keith my phone number.
Okay.
And at the time, I'll never figure out how he had my phone number, but they came over, Keith and Martin and Louie.
Right.
And we all started talking, and we went down to A&M Records because Keith knew a couple of the people who worked there, Bob Garcia in A&R and the other fellow in artist relations, used to be the Hollies road manager for years.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to A&M. Well, they just couldn't have been nicer. I mean, they just said, what do you want? What do you need?
Right.
And so Keith said, well, you know, we're having a bit, you know, we need this and that. And we're having some, you know. And they said, do you need a place to rehearse? How about our soundstage here?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So they just couldn't have been nicer. And D. Anthony happened to be one of the major rock managers working with the A&M company.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it was intentional. It just sort of evolved.
Right.
So you know they had Joe Cocker, and then Peter. And they had Humble Pie, my dear friends, and they had, I can't remember the rest of them. And so when we were in there talking to the aforementioned Bob Garcia, wonderful guy, he calls D. Anthony back in New York. Hey, D, there's this group of people performing here. A&M's going to be involved with them seriously. Are you interested in talking to him about management, quote unquote? So, no sooner had, we gone outside to get, a Coke or something, there was D. And so that's how we got involved with D. And that was a tremendous band.
Armageddon was such a good band. You know, it's just such a shame. You know, incredible musicians. I never really heard a lot of promotion when that album came out. It was kind of like an underground thing.
I'll tell you why. It wasn't that A&M wasn't willing to put the money in.
Mm-hmm.
They could not. I repeat, they could not find our manager. They couldn't find him. And so.
Oh, gosh.
Unbelievable. They couldn't find our manager.
Where was he?
Well, I don't know. But if you can't find the manager for approval, the record company just can't go ahead and just do whatever they think is in your best interest because they don't have the first chain of command, sort of, as it were.
Mm.
And Jerry Moss is an unbelievable man. I don't know if you ever met Jerry Moss, but he was the M of A&M, and he said, "I'll do. What do you need?" He just said, "I'll give you anything you want, literally." And generous, spectacular. But the reason you didn't see all that promotion for Armageddon was because I think there was some questions as to, are we going to get? Is this going to pay off if we start? You know. Spending money, it wasn't their belief or disbelief in the music or the band. They just, they knew that we were stuck.
Right.
I mean, quite honestly.
Then, Keith, you had asthma issues, and I guess it became emphysema. And then, of course, he passed away in 1976. But you guys, you and Pew got together and tried to reform the band, right? And back in, what, the 80s?
In the early 80s, we did.
And you had some interest from Capitol Records.
Big time interest. They were talking upwards to $1 million to sign it. And
What happened there?
Those things are so much about timing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when people come down to see you,
Right.
They may be just over the moon, but they've got to go and talk to the next person, too, and see if they can bring them down.
Right.
So they went. This guy that was the one that was really knocked out went and brought Bobby Colombi, the drummer, used to be with Blood, Sweat, Tears.
Right.
He was working for Capitol at the time. So they brought Bobby down, and then they brought some other people down. I don't really know, Ray, exactly what. I don't really know what happened on that, honestly. But it was a great band. They were, I mean, I love Martin and Lily to this day. Yeah, there was problems as in anything, and you know, you're young, and then when things start going off the rails a little bit, you know, everyone gets disgruntled. You can't find the manager. Where are we going?
Yeah.
People are people, and they have personal, personal private problems that they're going through. And I'm not talking about the first thing people think is drugs. I'm talking about it could be, you know, their ex-wife or.
Right, right.
You know, there's always something going on.
Yeah.
So, and Keith, I cannot, I have to take a moment to tell you what a great musician this guy was, what a spectacular human being, and I really mean that, just a wonderful guy. He's the kind of guy that was so humble that you couldn't really believe you were talking to him.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know, those type of people where you're going, you know, they'll say, well, why don't you have a go at this, you know? Are you sure? Yeah. Why don't you, why don't you try? You sing it first. You know, I mean, just, I'm going to tell you a quick anecdote about Keith Relf for everybody.
Sure, sure.
During the studio at one point, during the middle of a couple of takes, I walked out to the control, out to the main room there at Olympic Studios. And Keith and I were just out there alone, you know. And he says, he goes, you know, Bobby, I think I'd like to, you know, get my voice, you know, a wee bit more gruff sounding, a little bit more edge, this and that. And I'd really like to, you know, get a little bit more on that. And I, you know, a bit like Paul Rogers.
Right, right, right.
And I stopped him, Ray, and I said, Keith, I had no idea what prompted me to say this, but I said, Keith, that's, if you want to do that just for the sake of the tonality and the whole thing for the song, that's fine. I said, but you're Keith Relf. I said, you don't need to copy anybody.
Right.
You don't need to sound like any of the Hellbody. You're
right.
Keith Relf. I mean, just like I'm saying it to you is how I said it to him. And he just smiled and, you know, and thanked me. And it was almost like I had to remind him, you know, this guy, that, you know, I said, you're a bloody legend. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
That's funny. I talked to John Anderson of Yes, and we were talking about when he first met George Harrison, and he was so afraid to meet George Harrison in person, and he was hiding from him. I said, "Why? You're John Anderson from Yes." He says, "Yeah, but he's a Beatle. He's a Beatle." So,
right.
You know, it just shows you know that people are, musicians are very humble. You know, they don't think a lot.
Yeah.
About, you know?
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And
speaking of the Beatles, you jam with Lennon and Ringo Starr, right? At a party?
I did.
At
John and May Pang's. In fact, I was talking to them a while ago about this.
The Lost Weekend.
At the Lost Weekend, yeah. And everyone was there at this private party at the record plant. Everybody was, well, that could get in.
How cool is
and
that?
And this cat, one of the guys working for Captain Beyond, calls me up. He says, hey, how'd you like to come down to John Lennon's having a big party down here? And, you know, maybe play or hang out a little bit. And so I said, wow, really? you know, and he said, yeah. I said, you sure you can get me in? You know, he said, oh, yeah, I'll get you in. So I walk up to the door, and the guy waves me in, and I walk in, and the first person I see is my old friend Joe Vitale, drummer with Joe Walsh now and with Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Right.
He's the first one I see, and all the music's being played and all that stuff, and I look up on the stage, and there's two drum sets. And Joe says, are you going to play? And I said, I don't know, Joe. I said, I'm just got here. I'm just looking around to see what's doing, you know. And so, I don't know, maybe a little half hour, an hour later or something, I got up and played and jammed with them for a little while, and Ringo was playing the other drum set. And it was a real learning experience and a real thrill. You know, John was playing guitar, and Nilsson was there. Everyone was there.
Nilsson, yeah. I think
Clapton might have been there. I mean, everyone was there.
Yeah.
And
pretty cool.
So, yeah, that's what happened. And, and I really wanted to talk to John, you know, really just about things I've often wondered, you know, which would have been very, but I never had a chance to. No, and I became very good friends with Derek Taylor, who was their press officer, you know, and sort of would ask Derek about the Beatles or what was going on and why did this happen like this or, you know, that kind of stuff. And, but that's what happened that night. Yeah, that was a big event.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's funny because I never think about that. You know, it's kind of things that you happen to be at, but unless somebody reminds you of it, you really don't think much about it. You know, if you said, oh, you played the World Albert Hall or, you know, Disney, you go, yeah, man, it was really great. Because that's something you would remember all the time.
Sure.
Or the Hollywood Bowl. But some of these things that have happened, I've been very blessed to have done it and to be there. And, you know, but I don't readily think about them very often. And you did.
Yeah, and you were at George Harrison's Dark Horse Records party too in L.A.
Boy, oh boy, yeah, you've really done your homework. Yes, I was. That was over at the Century City Hotel.
Yeah, I stayed there.
I don't think those rooms are going for $59 a night. Yeah, they had a. You know what that was? That thing when George was there. That was an honor, a hosting of him starting Dark Horse Records, and A&M had paid for that. That's what that was. A&M had paid for that private party. For George and as a sort of a kickoff for Dark Horse Records. You know. Yep. I didn't really talk to George that night either. He was standing 4 feet away from me, you know. But, you know, sometimes you don't want to say anything. You don't want to make people feel uncomfortable. And maybe they don't want to bother with you, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of, you know, like Gary Wright was good friends of George. The closest I got to John was Julian. I interviewed Julian Lennon, which was kind of cool because it's kind of sounded like John on the phone, you know?
He does sound like him a little bit, yeah.
He does. And he's a great guy. He's such a nice guy.
Did you get some good questions answered?
Oh, yeah. You don't want to talk too much about the Beatles with him. You just want to talk about Julian, because he's a gifted artist, too, you know? And
he's
done a lot of good stuff in his career. And, you know, even the son of a Beatle gets, you know, hard to get, you know, good PR today. And because, you know, music, his kind of music is not being played on, you know, traditional radio. And it's a shame.
Well, when he had that hit record in the late 80s, that was it. And that's been, a pretty very difficult road to hoe for him. And I don't think it's been very fair because...
It's not fair. You know, his last album is excellent, you know?
Yeah, nobody, you know, it's like, well, this isn't John, so, you know, this can't be that good. So let's move on to the next one. What's that next one? You know,
yeah.
I don't think he, you know, I think it's been very tough for him. Where's he living now?
Let's see. I think he's in Spain, if I can remember. I thought he was in Spain. He does a lot of photography now. He's really good at it. But super nice guy. Really, really nice guy.
I'm sure he is. Yeah. Wow. And Gary Wright, too. He's a talented guy as well.
Yes, he is. I just want to remind the audience some of the other wonderful things you've done. When you performed with the Allman Brothers live at Fillmore East, you were the drummer, and you also were the drummer with Johnny Winter, who was actually the headliner of that show. And I think Elvin Bishop was the warm-up act. But you played
with both
bands.
That's correct. When you see the, and this brings me with a heavy heart here to hear about my dear friend Greg, and feeling sick right now as we're doing this interview, and I can't tell you how saddened I am to hear of the way he's doing. And but you're right. The Johnny Winter Band was the headliner that night at the Fillmore East, and special guest the Allman Brothers Band, who were by this time just killing it, and Elvin Bishop was the opener.
Yeah.
So I've been on the road with the Allman Brothers for ages. So, I mean, I played their set, and then I played percussion on a few things, and then I think I played drums on Midnight Rider and a few things.
Wow.
And then once we got finished that, I came back. With Black Change Coat came out and played with Johnny and did that. And then we did the same thing all over again. And I think I needed about a week to recover. I'm serious. Because you didn't get out of there till 5:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And after playing two drum solos and that kind of intensity, you know, you were pretty well knackered, I'll tell you. So, yeah, that was us. We were, and when you see the live album by the Almonds, you know, live at the Fillmore East, it kind of gives the impression that they were the headliner, and that, I mean, they could have been, but yeah. It just so happens that we were the headliner, and the Allman Brothers were second, and they were just playing tremendous. And Dwayne came back and asked me at the hotel, asked me if I wanted to join the band.
Yeah. Would have been a perfect fit, I think.
Well, it would have been something. You know, those guys, what people don't understand about the Allman Brothers is that they would have sounded the same way if they'd been in Fargo, North Dakota. I mean, there's nothing in the water that makes you sound like you do. And I told somebody one time we were talking on an interview. I said, the Allman Brothers, I don't even know why you call them Southern Rock, I asked the guy. I mean, what, just because they were living in Macon? I mean, come on.
Yeah,
I mean, they could be living anywhere. But, you know, that was a magical sort of get-together. The road crew all got along great. The band got along great. When they call themselves as brothers in a sort of cliche world, they really were. In the early days, it was all about them. I mean, they were like a 14-member family. I mean that. And they were just very supportive, great, great guys. Always having fun. I mean, I can't tell you how many nights, you know, Greg and I would sit around laughing about things. I mean, Greg stayed with me at my parents' house for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I just want to tell the audience, you reminded me today, and something I didn't know, that Greg Allman is in hospice, and I did not know that. So, it's sad news.
Yeah. It's really, really, you know, I'm just crushed thinking about it, honestly, and is going back as far as we go back. Noah's Ark played with the Allman Brothers at a Battle of the Bands in Gainesville, Florida. Okay, dig this way. There was like 8,000 bands there. you know, and the music store was giving away all these instruments for the first place and second place. You know, you get a free popcorn maker or whatever, and a Gibson Les Paul with the popcorn maker. And if you're this guy, you get this, and this big drum set they gave away. And, to the best drummer and all this stuff. Well, the Allman Brothers were one of the bands at this Battle of the Bands. Now, the first album had just been done. And I always used to, I laugh so hard when I would be teasing Greg or Dwayne going, excuse me, didn't you guys get honorable mention in that thing? And didn't Noah's Ark come in second? I think that's the way it was.
Really?
And,
in second?
Yeah, the way it was, yeah. I mean, you know, we got second place, and they got honorable mention or something, but it was one of the funniest things. I thought, you talk about it. Oh, that was just too much. So they would all laugh about it, too, as if they cared at that point. You know?
I got to ask you, Greg lived for a little while in Bradenton. He lived in Anna Marie Island, and they used to frequently go to the Ore House, and he used to hang out and drink there.
What kind of house?
The Ore House, O-A-R House.
Oh, okay, O-A-R, okay.
Did you ever see him in Bradenton here when he was hanging out here for a while?
There's a joke in there somewhere, but I'm not going to say it.
I know where you're headed.
I didn't say anything. I was living in L.A. at that time, so
okay.
I would have never seen him. Did you run into him down there?
I did not. I wasn't in Florida back then. I was still in D.C.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got just a few minutes here. I wanted to say a couple things. You know, AllMusic, you know, they've actually credited you for the other Bobby Caldwell's hit, What You Won't Do for Love, by the way. If you go to AllMusic, they got you in there and credited that song to you.
Isn't that nice of them?
Do you ever get mixed up with online with the other Bobby Caldwell?
Not very often. You know, in the early days, just to bore you with the details, I used to get some of that, and quite frankly, having had, you know, my first gold album at 20 years old, I mean, you know, you work hard for that, and this guy came along, and I'm just putting the record straight here. And he, you know, this was like 7 years later, and he's got a big record, great record. I mean, as far as commerciality, and but he's got the same name, and I'm thinking, really? But you can't in the United States. I would have been quite happy, you know, if and the irony of it was the fact that he's from Florida. And it would have been almost impossible to have come out of Florida at some point in those times and not have known. And I'm not saying this to sound you know, in a braggart way boastful. It's just, you know, you more than likely, if you're in the music business, you probably heard my name somewhere. I mean, in those times, in the mid to late 60s and so on. So I'm sure he's a terrific guy, and but I don't think it was something I could control. They don't allow you in the United States to you can't use the same name in other countries like in England,
right?
You know, David Bowie or John Paul Jones or David Jones or
right.
You know, you can't use the same name. But that only happened in the early in the early days where a few people, not very seldom does it get mixed up now, but.
Poor Frank Marino, he was in Mahogany Rush, guitar player. Poor Frank Marino, if you look, punching Frank Marino, the other Frank Marino is a female impersonator, and it's all over the internet.
Really?
Yeah. There's another Frank Marino that's a female impersonator when you punch it in.
Are you serious? Really? I mean, you're not kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding. So, you know, when you go to Frank Marino, you're going to see that. So
you can imagine some of his high school friends going back, but boy, things have changed, you know.
Yeah. So being the other Bobby Caldwell is a good thing because at least he's got a big hit out there. He's a good, you know, good artist.
Well, there's Peter Wolf, and there's I guess there's a bunch of different views. There's Beck. I mean, there's a lot of people. as long as you can separate it by either what you do stylistically or this or that.
Exactly.
Maybe it's, you know, it's that's what you're going to, you know, that's what you got to deal with.
Bobby, you're a really interesting guy. The other thing you do, you got your master's in metaphysics. How cool is that? Wow. And then you became a metaphysical minister. What's the difference between a metaphysical minister and a regular minister?
Well, you're still dealing with the same principles
right.
and things like that. Metaphysical type things are done with a lot of affirmation, a lot of prayer, a lot of different things. I don't use the, I've always had an interest in mysticism since I was a child.
Sure.
I mean, a little boy. And I have had a really serious interest in all spiritualism, everything to do with, obviously believing in God, number one, of course. But everything to do with, I don't want to freak anybody out here, but, you know, UFOs and different things from different worlds. I know I've spent a lot of time with that, and I've been into a lot of very interesting situations spiritually. So, to use your reverendship, if you want to do that, I mean, I can do funerals, I could do weddings and stuff, but... You know, you need to do that all the time if that's what you're going to do, if you're going to use it. And I don't do that all the time. You know, I'm doing music most of the times. But I can talk about metaphysics at any time, you know, about it, anytime somebody wants to talk about it. But
we'll have to get you on the show again to really get into it, because that's I'm very interested in the same subject. I think it's
really
especially reincarnation. I do kind of believe in that. That it could happen.
That's what I did. That's what I did my master's treatise on. That's what I did
on
8,000 plus words. That's what I did on karma and reincarnation. Is what I did it on. You have to pick a subject to write on.
Right.
And that's very interesting. Anytime you want to talk about that, I'll be happy to talk to you. I'll give you my. My home number, you've got it, and we can talk sometime at great length about that.
That'll be wonderful. Have you ever seen anything out of the norm? You know, like, have you seen a UFO? Have you seen spirits or anything like that?
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Hmm.
But I don't want all these lovely people to think, oh, God, I heard this thing at Bobby. He sounds like he lost his mind. I haven't lost my mind yet, but...
there are countless TV shows on the subject, so you wouldn't be the only one.
No, I'd have plenty of company.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. You have to, you know, this subject is a subject that people have to listen to with a very open mind.
Yep.
And realize, as in any field, there are charlatans. There are people who are frauds. And those are the people that I just have the highest disdain for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the people that are absolutely sincere and have done and experienced things that, you know, the average person doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very real, and it's very real. I've seen... plenty of UFOs. I actually ran into an extraterrestrial on a path one day.
Wow.
That's another long story. Yeah.
So we'll get you on again, and we'll definitely go over that.
We can do it. Yeah, or just call me.
Yeah, I asked Chris Squire if he believed in UFOs. He says that he thought UFOs were us from the future.
Is that what he said?
Uh-huh. Yeah. He thought they were future.
Keith Wolf was really into mysticism and spiritualism. Keith was.
Mm-hmm.
Big time, Keith was. Yeah, and he would tell me about... So was Rod Evans. A lot of English people you know, England is a very lot of hauntings over there.
Oh yeah.
And I stayed. I mean, in Armageddon, we stayed in Wales at the castle, and I mean, to tell you, this place was haunted. I mean, at every turn. I mean, no kidding. And so you had to be able to deal with it in order to, to not get really freaked out by it. But there's a lot of English people in all of the things. They seem to have a different perception of that.
You'll need to get together with Jimmy Page. You guys will have a lot in common. I think he.
Jimmy,
I don't know if he still lives in the castle or not, but I know he did at one point.
Which castle?
I'm not sure which one, but we'll have to look it up. But
probably anyone he wants.
Yeah, but he believes in the hauntings and things like that. He goes beyond that.
Well, I think Jimmy was dealing with a lot of Crowley and black magic stuff.
Crowley, the black magic stuff.
That's not what I'm dealing with. Is everything of the light of God,
right,
and the righteousness. And you see, the Earth has been around for 200,000 years. I mean, and during this time, many, many groups from different planets have come here. And they don't just come here necessarily and skip off, you know. They do. They'll leave.
Yeah.
But they come here because it's here. And
right,
they are of a much higher dimension, for the most part, in terms of their spirituality. That's the word to use. And these people come here sometimes for soil samples. Sometimes they'll check the, you know, how livestock is. Sometimes, I mean, they even will fraternize with the, you know, the Earth people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many cases of that. I don't know if you know about Valiant Thor, the man from Venus that ended up spending 3 years at the Pentagon. Did you know about that?
No, I don't think I heard that.
There's a man named Valiant Thor.
Right, okay.
If I could say it, Valiant Thor.
Okay.
And there's a beautiful book written about Valiant Thor.
Huh.
And that he actually met with Eisenhower and wanted to help fix so many of the ills, because they're so far ahead of us in terms of their spirituality. But these people have been coming here forever.
Yeah.
In fact, they are the major, most of these travelers, we'll call them. They're called travelers in many areas, and they are trying to keep peace on this earth. You know, when these things go wrong on the earth and things don't happen and people are trying to test a bomb or this or that, and
right,
they're watching over this place because they don't want anything happen to it. And,
yeah,
and mankind, being stupid as they are, you know, in many cases, don't realize sort of what they're doing. You know, they don't realize that the firecracker could blow up if you're not careful. So.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting stuff, man. I really believe in the dimensions as well, you know, things that we can't see that are really there, you know.
Well, absolutely. Well, that's how the UFOs aren't seen most of the time. It's because of the way they can dematerialize themselves.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff on Star Trek, you saw Star Trek as a kid.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's a lot of things have come
true. Most of that stuff is accurate.
Yeah.
So then you have to ask yourself, whoa, wait a second here. Who behind the scenes was the major people that was bringing this forth?
Right.
Oh, yeah. It's all happening, as
yep,
they say. But
I agree.
You know, anytime you want to, you know, talk about it, let me know. I'll be happy to talk
okay,
about
sure,
it. Okay, sure.
I'd like to get you on the show again just to talk about that. That'd be very interesting.
As long as I don't scare anybody off. I don't want to do that, you know.
Bobby, what's next for you? You got this tour going on. What's you said you're thinking about, I don't know, maybe an album with Captain Beyond?
Yeah, we're going to do an album down the road.
Okay.
So we're looking forward to doing that.
Okay.
But we've got some time that we want to play together and get things really tight and
sure.
And sore, you know, but that's coming up down the road. We'll be doing that for sure.
Awesome. Bobby, mm-hmm. Thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. We'll get you on again. You're a very interesting guy. I'll definitely see you and the rest of Captain Beyond at Aces Live Music on June 3rd. You'll be in Bradenton for that. That's a,
yep.
a great place to see the band.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you, Ray, and hopefully we have some time to talk. And
yep.
I've enjoyed it very, you know, thoroughly, and I want to say hello to everyone out there that reads this or hears it, and to tell you all, God bless you, and you know, I hope to be able to see someone down the road here when we're playing somewhere in your neighborhood.
All right, man. Thank you so much. You are awesome.
Thank you so much. Great talking with you, Ray.
Me too. Take care.
All right. God bless. Okay. Bye-bye.
You can purchase Lost and Found, 1972 through 73. The release date is going to be June 2nd on CD and limited edition colored LP at Cleopatra Music and Film. Go on their website, check it out, and this is going to be an awesome release. For more information about Bobby Caldwell and show dates for Captain Beyond, visit www.theofficialbobbycaldwellsite.com and www.officialcaptainbeyond.com. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly, Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at raypublicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio Station 1.